You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Whether it's the Somalis who've been moving to Maine or the Southeast Asians in Iowa, new immigrants have been bypassing the traditional gateway cities like New York and Los Angeles to settle in smaller towns across the U.S. Douglas S. Massey, a professor of sociology and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School, has edited a book that explores the changing demographics of immigration and the ways in which native-born Americans are dealing with their new neighbors. It's called New Faces in New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration. It's published by Russell Sage Foundation, and it is my pleasure to welcome Professor Massey to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. It's great to be here.
When did immigrants start bypassing traditional gateway cities?
It really starts in the early 1990s, and there were a lot of moving parts that came together to make it happen. One of the most important was the selective hardening of the Mexico-U.S. border, making it very difficult and costly to cross, especially from Tijuana into San Diego. And as a result, the flows were deflected away from Tijuana, San Diego, which had been responsible for about 70% of the crossings, and pushed outward and away from the state. About the same time, California hit a big recession after the end of the Cold War in 1992-93, and coincident with the recession, there was a nasty anti-immigrant mobilization. And immigrants somehow got the idea that they just weren't so welcome in California anymore.
But what about New York? I'm still seeing a lot of immigrants here, and I would assume that there are more employment opportunities in big cities like New York and Chicago.
What's happening in places like New York and Chicago is they've continued to attract lots of immigrants, and they're coming into new areas as a diffusion process away from New York. So parts of New York State and the upstate that didn't used to get immigrants are now getting immigrants, largely as kind of a step function, step migration out of New York, likewise in New Jersey. But California has ceased being the destination that it used to be, and especially for Mexicans. Between 1985 and 90, Two-thirds of Mexicans went to California. At present, one-third of Mexicans go to California.
Well, we can understand that. They were joining already established communities where people spoke their language, where there were shops that were stocked with their foods. Are they finding those things in small towns?
Well, not when they get there, but they're creating them for themselves. So there's been a radical transformation of a lot of places that not only haven't had Mexican immigrants before, they haven't had any immigrants before. So the most rapidly growing Mexican populations are now in places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Iowa, Georgia, Nebraska, and they're filling up small towns.
Well, in New York, we'll talk about the Mexicans just a moment longer. There were hardly any Mexicans for many years, and then some Pueblans came, and then the next thing you knew, we had a lot of Mexicans here because there were kinship networks. Are these kinship networks also working in these small towns?
Kinship networks always work powerfully when immigration flows get started. So they get started by some idiosyncratic process of recruitment or something that happens to start bringing people in. And then once people are there, they draw on their friends and relatives. And the employers know they have friends and relatives, so they ask them to recruit their friends and relatives, and it becomes a self-sustaining process.
Also, many of these immigrants come from rural areas, don't they? Would they feel more comfortable in small towns?
Well, especially in the case of the New York area, there's a diffusion out of New York for people looking for more tranquil small towns, small community environments, and trying to get away from the big urban problems of places like New York.
Well, in the old days, people came here as singles. Now we're seeing more family units, aren't we? So there would be that feeling that I wouldn't want to live in an SRO while I establish myself.
Yeah, and that's especially true for Mexicans, who are by far the biggest immigrant group in the United States. And again, that's a function of our own hardening of the border. The ironic effect of raising the costs and risks of border crossing is that people don't stop coming, but once they've paid those costs, they hunker down and stay. And as they stay longer, the men start bringing up their families, and you switch from a circular flow of male workers to a settled population of families.
Are these trends the same whether the immigrants are legal or illegal?
They're more pronounced for illegal migrants because they're the ones that face all the costs and risks of border crossing. But what a lot of Americans don't understand is that most of these families are in very mixed status. And so there will be legal and citizens and illegals in the same family. And because the illegals can't move, they act as an anchor, rooting everybody else north of the border. So their rates of return migration have also fallen.
We actually broadcast a story by a high schooler who discovered that she wasn't legal even though her father had become a citizen. He hadn't had the whole family naturalized, and she was faced with deportation even though she had grown up in the United States.
Oh, that happens quite a bit, and as Congress has written and rewritten the immigration laws, they made the immigration system very unforgiving, and all of the onus falls on the backs of the poor immigrants. So if the immigration system loses your paperwork and you fall out of status, it becomes your problem.
Well, we've had waves of immigrants in the past. Are we seeing record numbers now? I've heard from the 1970s on, it's been incredible.
Well, there's been a huge increase in immigration since really the late 1960s is when the uptick started. And in absolute terms, we're back up to where we were about in the early part of the 20th century. Of course, in relative terms, the United States is much, much bigger. And so as a percentage of the population, immigrants are still smaller than they were, say, around 1920.
But in the early part of the 20th century, late 19th, we were welcoming those immigrants. Now we're not so welcoming. They're coming here because they're searching for economic opportunity, or because they're escaping repression as they did in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, as always, immigrants come with a combination of motives, but the most important motive is economic opportunity and betterment. And for neighboring countries in Mexico and Latin America, most of their mobility aspirations are actually focused at home. So a guest worker program would make sense for a lot of these kinds of workers. They want to earn money in the U.S., maybe on one or two trips for a short period of time, and then invest it at home and go home.
Well, that was the case in the past.
Absolutely.
Where we had these guest workers who'd work in the American farms. But that's happening less and less as well. And it seems to me many of the people who are coming here are working in industries like meatpacking and food processing.
Well, meatpacking, the whole food processing industry has been completely transformed in the past decade or so. And we've shifted to huge plants that are very efficient, and they've taken the process of processing meat and de-skilled it down to small little steps, and people are forced to work at a stationary post doing the same thing over and over and over again. And as a result, turnover is like 100% in a year. And so this is not a permanent job. This is an immigrant job, because nobody's going to stay there all day long for 365 days for 10 years and do it.
Are these plants in rural areas?
Yes, deliberately. The restructuring of the food processing industry involved building brand new, gigantic plants out of cities, both because the land was cheaper out of cities and because there were no unions in these places.
Have the immigrants been willing to work longer, stay longer at these terrible jobs than the native-born Americans?
Well, there are a few Native Americans in these jobs, but they're not jobs that anyone can possibly hold for very long. So the injury rate, the burnout rate is so high that even the best workers with the highest motivation will only stay a couple of years.
And I'm guessing again that we're talking mostly about illegal immigrants in these kinds of awful jobs.
Yeah, mostly illegal immigrants, but some legal immigrants and some citizens as well.
My guest is Douglas S. Massey of Princeton. His book, New Faces in New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration, is published by the Russell Sage Foundation. And we're talking about changes in the way immigrants are assimilating into this country, if they are assimilating. Are some of these immigrants revitalizing the towns that were suffering from loss of population as young people left?
Absolutely. Some of these towns were dying and disappearing, and now they're vibrant communities again.
So are they seen by the locals as a positive development?
It varies, and that's one of the things we want to try to understand in the next couple of years as we investigate. Why, in some areas, are immigrants welcomed, and And the locals take actions to try to incorporate them and make them feel part of the community. In other places, there's heavy resistance.
But what happens over time? Have there been studies to analyze how the relationship between the immigrant group and the natives changes over the long term?
Well, in some of these communities, immigration is so new, we don't have a long term to look at. We do know that immigrants who come into these communities very quickly shift into English, and their children grow up speaking English, and English is, in the second generation, is the predominant language, with Spanish as the second language. And it's even faster in places like small town North Carolina, because than New York or Los Angeles, because there's no Spanish-speaking population.
Well, you're talking mostly, again, about Mexicans or people from Central America, but what about Asians? What about people who are coming over from Africa?
You find the same pattern there, and because those population groups are smaller and Asian immigrants speak a variety of different languages, the shift into English is even faster among the second generation. And the first generation, it's, you know, it's hard to learn a new language, and that transfer is never perfect. But the children all learn English very quickly, and because Asians and Africans come from a variety of different linguistic backgrounds, English becomes their lingua franca.
Well, as anyone who's ridden New York cabs more than once knows, many of the cab drivers who are just trying to survive are very well educated. They come here, often they're doctors and engineers, and they just can't make it in this country.
Well, the most selective groups of immigrants with the highest qualifications are the ones where it's hardest to get in, and it's really hard to make it from sub-Saharan Africa into the U.S. So African immigrants tend to be very highly educated and very selective. And the problem is that many of them received PhDs abroad, or if they got their PhDs here, they weren't going to the best schools, and they're language and licensing problems. Even though they speak English with a heavy accent, and that presents a barrier to them.
And isn't there a quota program for immigrants getting highly skilled jobs in this country?
Well, we've restructured the American immigration system to make legal permanent resident visas more accessible to skilled immigrants. And kind of quietly behind the scenes, especially in the late 1990s, we dramatically increased the size of temporary worker visas for skilled workers, the so-called H-1B visas.
So we have companies saying we need to have more people from India work for our company, and the government saying, no, you could only have so many. And I see both sides, because the possibility is that some of these, for example, Silicon Valley places might very well see the immigrant engineers, highly skilled, as being willing to work for less than American-trained engineers.
Well, there doesn't seem to be that effect. People that are skilled command the highest salaries, and immigrants if they have legal rights, they command the same salaries as everybody else. And, of course, it's a global economy, and so now the other process that's going on is outsourcing of computer services. So you have a high-tech person, you have a highly skilled programmer, and they can work and live much more cheaply in Bangalore than in Silicon Valley. And so the alternative to bringing people in is just to outsource the work to the foreign destinations.
But that doesn't seem to have cut down on immigration.
It hasn't cut down on the demand for immigrants, because you can't outsource everything, and there are advantages to having a bunch of people in the same place at the same time working on the same problems.
My guest is Douglas S. Massey, Henry G. Bryant Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. He's edited a book called New Faces in New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration, published by Russell Sage Foundation. We will continue our conversation after this. Later in this hour, French soprano Nathalie Desai on her revolutionary approach to singing. Then in the second hour, a humorous look at the science of sex. And we'll also hear about the long history of the Kurdish struggle for nationhood. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Now the entire show is available as a podcast. Would you believe it? We're back with Douglas S. Massey, who's edited a book called New Faces in New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration, published by Russell Sage Foundation. How are illegal or low-skilled immigrants being treated in places where there are large populations of poor American citizens?
Well, I think if you look at the opinion data that we've collected, it seems that most of the antagonism comes from working class white Americans.
Do they really want those jobs at those meatpacking plants?
Well, yes and no. They want the jobs that existed before, a unionized job in a much smaller plant that paid high wages and marketed to the United States. But those plants in the global economy no longer exist. And so to respond to global pressures, to compete with meat producers or chicken producers in other countries, they've had to cut costs relentlessly. And that has meant de-skilling and de-unionizing and creating a set of jobs that most Americans wouldn't want to have. Now, you could say, okay, well, America shouldn't have those jobs. But then the plants go overseas entirely, and there are no, and the plants being here do support a whole tier of jobs for Americans.
What about race? In this country, we've thought about it largely in terms of white and black. But now we're seeing people of different skin tones.
Well, it's really introducing a new note of complexity in American race relations and changing the traditional color line between black and white and making it much fuzzier and much more complex. And this is nowhere more true than in the South, because the South is, with the exception of places like Texas or Florida, Deep South has never received immigrants in any significant numbers.
And now many of these immigrants are going to the Deep South.
And it's creating a lot of unease because it people don't know how to act and react, and they're upsetting a long balance that has been prevailing in those parts of the country.
But all throughout the country, at least there's a reputation of small towns as being parochial and suspicious of outsiders.
Well, that's true in general, but some towns are more welcoming than others, and it varies a lot by education and class. So well-educated people, people in upper management and upper middle class positions, usually welcome the immigrants for the economic growth that's associated with their arrival. The poor, lower class, middle and working class people not only feel the competition, but they also have less experience dealing with people from other cultures speaking other languages, and they're less tolerant of those differences.
And we've seen some violence, violence either just because of anti-immigrant feelings, and in some cases, violence because somebody's wearing a turban. A Sikh might very well be killed. In fact, I've heard of a number of cases because he wears a turban, even though Sikhs have nothing to do with Osama bin Laden.
Well, things have gotten much worse since 9/11. And a lot of political entrepreneurs in the United States have made it their business to mobilize a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment and deliberately conflate immigrants and immigration with the war on terror, when in fact there's virtually no relationship between the two. It's true that the terrorists on 9/11 were foreigners, but they weren't immigrants to the United States. They used temporary visas to enter with fraudulent purposes. And, you know, more militarizing the Mexican-U.S. border more is not going to solve that problem.
Because there wasn't one Mexican in that group, that 9/11 group.
Well, it was Mexicans got killed in the towers. They were the busboys at the Windows on the World.
What determines how quickly these immigrants will assimilate? Are they more likely to assimilate in non-urban areas?
In general, they learn English faster in these smaller smaller communities where there aren't large densities of other Spanish speakers, other people speaking their languages. The biggest detriment to integration and assimilation is, of course, the fact that a lot of them are illegal, and illegality is a major problem. And I think it's really an unfolding human rights tragedy in the United States. Out of the 12 million people who are currently illegal, upwards of 3 million of them entered as children. And they're guilty of no sin except obeying their parents, and frequently they entered when they were 2 or 3 years old. And for these people, it's really a sin that we're letting them languish in illegal status with nowhere to go. They speak English. They grew up here. They went to high school. They've never been to the country they're originally born in, and yet they can be deported to this place at a moment's notice.
They want to buy a house like they're all the kids they went to school with.
The only thing they want to do is get on with their lives in this country, the only country they know.
And now some are being imprisoned in Hutto, Texas.
Some are being imprisoned. Some are being deported. It's breaking up families because the younger brothers and sisters were often born here and are American citizens.
The urban situation, as you point out, can actually hold people back. I used to live in Chinatown, and I knew a fair number of people who barely could speak English, even though they'd lived here for many years. They just had no need to speak anything but Cantonese. And they wound up always in lousy jobs within the Chinese community.
Well, the Chinese community is a little bit different than the Mexican community because China is so far away, and to get here requires such a big outlay. So there's a very well-organized smuggling operation that supplies labor to Chinatowns throughout the United States, and it's really an indentured form of servitude where they have to come up with so much money up front and pay the snakeheads, the smugglers, to get them into the United States, and they have to basically work here for 3 to 4 years full-time before they can even pay off their costs and start earning money to send home. And for them, the goal is to earn money to send home and then to return to the family, so there's very little incentive for assimilation.
On the other hand, there are services available, English as a second language. Is that true in these small towns as well?
No, that's one of the things that we've seen is that these smaller places don't have the usual range of services. They don't have the organizations put together by prior waves of immigrants to help the new waves arrive. And there are no English as a second language teacher, no bilingual instructors. There's very few materials available in the languages that they need to access to gain access to services.
Do these immigrants face more of an uphill climb than the ones faced by the European immigrants of a century or so ago?
Well, they do in two ways. One, we've already mentioned the illegality. And the other is the structure of the American economy. In the early 20th century, there were plentiful manufacturing jobs for people with limited education. And then, as it turned out, in the 30s, unions came onto the scene, and these jobs really turned into escalators for upward mobility for second and third generation immigrants. That structure no longer exists. We have the so-called hourglass economy with a lot of jobs at the bottom for people with limited education and manufacturing and services, and a lot of jobs at the top, and the ones in the middle have disappeared.
And also the older immigrants could eventually join unions and fight for higher wages and better conditions. It took a while, but they did. If you're illegal, even if you are a firebrand, you're going to remain as quiet as possible.
Yes, and I think that that's why legalizing the large number of people here is in the interests of American workers. The main reason that wages have stagnated at the bottom of the pyramid is because more and more people are out of status and have no rights. They don't have, not only do they not have labor rights, they don't have any rights whatsoever, and they're afraid to organize. And I think that unions have come around to realize this now, and a lot of unions are behind immigration reform efforts because they see this as a potential area for growth.
Mike, the union's shrinking. They got to grow one way or another. Douglas S. Massey is the editor of New Faces in New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration, published by the Russell Sage Foundation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopey. Let's look at some of the places you're writing about. Milwaukee. Well, it's not a small town, but it's not the largest city. It owes much to its German immigrants, but now the city is made up of 80,000 Hispanics, almost 15% of the population. Why have they migrated to Milwaukee?
Well, they're taking low-end service jobs, low-end manufacturing jobs in the city of Milwaukee.
Have they been welcomed?
They have been welcomed to a reasonable extent in a place like Milwaukee. Milwaukee, the line between blacks and whites is much harder than the line between the old white ethnics and the new Latinos coming in. They're both Catholics. They're both immigrants. They're both going to the same parishes. So the integration is smoother. And most of these people come initially from Chicago. And a lot of Americans don't realize that Chicago is the second largest Mexican community in the United States after Los Angeles.
It was established a long time ago.
In the 20s, it really became established. And now there are more than 700,000 Mexicans in the Chicago metropolitan area. It's a very Mexican part of the part of the United States. And so what you're seeing now is a lot of migration from Chicago up north, and as new families establish themselves in not only in Milwaukee, but in Minnesota and, you know, every place from Green Bay to Duluth. Once the families are there, then the networks begin to operate and pull people in.
Are these the places we might not have thought of as magnets for immigrants that you're writing about, or are there other places that might surprise us?
Well, as I said earlier, the fastest growing communities are small towns in North Carolina, South Carolina, and also the cities. Charlotte has a booming immigrant population. Raleigh-Durham has
not all because of meatpacking.
No, there it's construction and services. Things like custodial services, gardening, lawn care, child care, low-end medical services. As the population ages, there's one of the categories of employment that's going to explode is really kind of low-end medical services. The people that, you know, clean the hospitals, change the bedpans, do the low-end sorts of things. Immigrants are increasingly taking those jobs.
What about political parties? In the past, almost every immigrant group joined the Democrats, at least in the earliest stage. The legals here, are they mostly becoming Democrats as well?
Mostly, with a few exceptions. Cubans, of course, have been Republican for some time, although that's changing as the second and third generation become predominant and the first generation dies out.
Well, George Bush tried to woo Hispanics into the Republican Party. There have been other attempts in the past.
Well, it hasn't been very effective because the Republican Party has also been the most active in attacking immigrants and demonizing immigrants, both in California when Pete Wilson joined the Prop 187 bandwagon and rode to re-election, but then lost California to the Democrats for in the next 20 years. And Tom Tancredo, in his candidacy, he knew he would never win, but his only goal was to make immigration a salient issue and to pull all the other candidates in a much more conservative and restrictive direction.
Well, since small towns have tended to be more conservative politically, what is this going to mean for them with all of these immigrant groups moving into the small towns? Some of them, I'm sure, most of them are illegal, but some will be legals.
Well, yeah, and then, as children are born here, they're citizens. And over time, America is different from some of the countries in Europe where people can stay in non-citizen status generation after generation. Our problems tend to solve themselves after 18 years because after 18 years, all these kids who grew up here and were born here become voters. And you can only mobilize against immigrants so long. And once a congressional district has a certain percentage of people of foreign origin, then it becomes very unlikely that anti-immigrant politics will prevail there.
Well, immigrant politics kept FDR winning again and again and kept the Democrats in power for a while. Do you think that's going to happen here? Although I imagine in time as people become assimilated, they sort themselves out. Money will also be a factor.
Yes, but and you see this in the immigrant population with the best educated immigrants being somewhat more conservative than the less educated ones. But I think we're seeing that. We're seeing a lot of mobilization of the children of immigrants for their political purposes.
Are you suggesting that the country will look a lot different by 2050 as a result of this?
America always looks different 50 years hence, and it always has, and this will be no different. And if you try to project the way we think about the world 50 years ahead, we'll get it all wrong, because 50 years from now, the average American is going to be some combination of European, Asian, Afro origins, Latino origins, and it'll be a lot more mixed, and people won't think a thing about it.
Oh, it's interesting. We were talking earlier about how immigration played such an important role in some political races, but it's practically invisible right now. Do you think that once the Democrats decide on a candidate, immigration will become one of the big issues again?
No, because the Republican standard bearer is John McCain, who was co-author of the McCain-Kennedy immigration reform legislation. So he is not going to push immigration as a divisive issue, and he's not going to push the campaign in a restrictive direction. And the Democrats aren't going to bring it up. And so, therefore, I think it'll be a very quiet issue, and it won't be a prominent pole of division in this campaign, which could create a window after the election for some immigration reform.
Although John McCain has changed his position on a number of things, like tax cuts, could to appeal to a broader Republican base, he could do that with immigration as well, couldn't he? Or is it because he's from Arizona that he thinks in a certain way?
Well, the other senator from Arizona is quite restrictive on immigration, so I don't think Arizona confers any magic immunity to restrictive tendencies. But he was in the debates, the Republican debates, when Tom Crato was there pushing and pushing and pushing, he didn't step forward and change his position. So I think that in the general election, there's not any incentive for him to do that. I don't think there's much to be gained politically for him to take an anti-immigrant stance and reverse himself.
Douglas E. Massey is the editor of a book called New Faces and New Places, The Changing Geography of American Immigration. He is the Henry G. Bryant Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School. And the book, by the way, is published by Russell Sage Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, French opera star Nathalie Dessay. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.